The convoy would continue and she would not. The true moments of one's life were sadder for the fact that they must always be synchronised with the ordinary, with rail timetables, with breaks in the traffic.
"Well," she said, "thank you."
It came after a few minutes, a let-up in the flow. One heard other people's conversations again, over the engine noise. One looked up, and there was the opportunity. There was no time to fuss over it. The children crossed the street while they could. And now the soldiers came again, on and on, in their 2-ton trucks, blocking her view of her class. The Americans came in a ceaseless river to end the lease of evil on Earth. What loads this would impose on the heart, everyone was curious to discover, but it was said they carried fuel oil and provisions for 2 years. Their bulldozers bellowed, and red sparks roared from their stacks. The convoy came without end. The asphalt shrieked, and the children cheered. London's long siege was broken. The soldiers stood with their feet wide apart in the truck beds, saluting the children smartly. They raised eyebrows at the great mounds of rubble in the streets that the locals were too weary to arrange back into buildings. The Americans were tall men on full rations, and it clearly made no sense to them that exhaustion should have the last word in the common language of English.
"How come?"
Mary heard them yelling to each other over the noise of the engines.
"How come they just left it broken like this?"
April 1942. At the public record office, on the fourth day of trying, Zachary had found his father's name. He hadn't asked for help, and he hadn't wanted it. Now the rain came in with the wind. There was an avenue of chestnut trees, and he found the broadest for shelter. There was bright sun between the showers, and the light fell green through the leaves. Jackdaws pecked at the edges of the walkways. They hopped among the headstones, finding the worms the rain had brought up and helping them into the light. Next to his father's name, which he had recognised from long familiarity, had been some letters he could not decipher. He had frowned at the words in the register. Sometimes they could be made compliant. He had tried looking from the corner of his eye, then surprising them. The rain would soon blow through. On the graves, the jackdaws fussed at the moss that grew through the gravel. Zachary lit a cigarette. He had waited for a rainy day to be here alone. He had drawn his thumbs together, isolating each letter as Mary had shown him. He had made a one-letter prison between his thumbs and slid it across the first word.
E-A-S-T.
He had repeated the word to himself, then interrogated the whole sentence. East London Cemetery. Beside the location had been written a plot number for a mass grave. The rain stopped. Water dripped from the chestnut leaves, the city inverted in each drop. Zachary came from under the tree and walked among the numbered plots at the margins of the graveyard. There was so much freshly dug earth. Weeds would take before grass. His father's plot was marked with a 2-inch metal plaque on a wooden stave. The plot was 20 feet by 10, its boundary made with stakes and green twine. One didn't know how many were buried there. Zachary stood for a while. Dandelions covered the plot. There was a smell of wet earth.
"I'm sorry it took me so long," he said.
In the footlights, his father had addressed the audience at the close of every show.
"For those who couldn't be with us tonight."
Zachary flicked away his cigarette. He could start now. He would try south, across the Thames. There was a rumour that his kind was trying there. Flat rubble waited for them on the far bank of the river. Rubble to build on caught no one's attention but theirs. It did not catch the light, having no promise but what they brought with them. He tried not to be afraid. London was a lightening of the sky. It was the bloody last hour of a milk tooth. It was a city dying to begin. May 1942. Hilda poured tea, propped an elbow on her kitchen table, and read Simonson's note again.
"It was brave of you to include your photograph in the last letter. What a terrible mess,
You must be devastated. That pompadour will have to go. As for the scars, I do not see what you are fretting about. One hardly notices them. In any case, it is only your face. This is why we were all issued with two.
She held the aerogram to her cheek. It smelled of smoke and mail sacks. Through the open window, pigeons were cooing in that emollient, slightly medical way they had, as if it were a purgative for heartaches metropolitan. Having no photograph to hand, Simonson had drawn her a self-portrait in blue ink. He had made himself scrawny and bearded, more castaway than soldier. In his cartoon, he wore sergeant stripes and bawled at men on parade. Hilda thought it adorable that he was so touchy about his demotion. She resolved to sew him various insignia, denoting ranks of her invention, which she would include in subsequent letters.
You write that it was clever of Alistair to induce the two of us to correspond, but I do not think him bright. It will have been no more than simple visual association on his part, since you are rather pretty and I am strikingly handsome. I should also like to correct any lies with which he might have supplied you. He may claim that I correspond with several girls, while in fact I only have ink for you.
Hilda smiled. Well, and so what if the man wrote around? She thought his letters reckless and sweet, as unworn as London in May. Through the window the traffic rumbled. On the street, beneath the barrage balloons, couples finished each other's thoughts again. Strapped shoes had been brought out for the season, hems raised by an inch and a half. The capital had remembered itself. Hilda closed her eyes and breathed in the smell of the letter. How good it would be to fall in love. How perfectly, anciently new.
June 1942.
Yes, but I'm like a piano, said Hilda. I need men to move me.
And Simonson? Said Mary. I like the convenience of mail order.
They were at the Ritz, at a table where they could be seen from the door. Mary spread her hands on the pristine tablecloth.
But there's always some problem with the delivery, isn't there?
Oh, why do I feel so anxious?
Insufficient drink, said Hilda, snapping her fingers the instant her diagnosis was made. Two more gin fizzes appeared.
Thank you for coming out, said Mary. I know it's silly, but I couldn't wait for him on my own.
She brushed away ash where it had missed the ashtray and moved the flowers in their vase to catch the light from the chandelier at the centre of the room.
Did he say when he would come? Said Hilda. Straight from Waterloo, after 9 o'clock.
Any minute, then. Do stop fussing, or I shall have the waiter etherize you.
I just want everything to be perfect when he gets here. After all this, I couldn't bear for him to be put off by a little thing.
He didn't mind when I told him you were a wreck. I shouldn't think he'll mind ash on the tablecloth.
You're quite right, said Mary, thinking that Hilda was quite wrong.
The heart was a bicameral thing, both stoical and skittish. Who was to say that it mightn't endure the years of separation and the abrupt reversals of fate, only to be repulsed by a misaligned vase, by a lipstick tooth, by a hundredth of an ounce of ash?
I've been meaning to ask, said Hilda. Where did you get that hat?
White's, in Burlington Arcade. Do you like it?
I actually think I must eat it.
Thank you, said Mary. The feathers are real phoenix, you know.
And your dress is just right. Any more décolletage, and you'd look rather as if you might. Any less, and you'd look as if you might rather not.
When Hilda was on form, she was hard to resist. And in any case, it was fun to be back at the Ritz, which seemed to have excused Mary sooner than her family had. Here they honoured one's name in that generous way the Ritz knew, which was to remember it only when one was sober. Seated at the grand, the pianist played some Schumann. Mary began to believe that everything really might be all right. Since Alistair's exoneration, they had exchanged letters almost weekly while he waited for a convoy home. Her letters were full of apology, his of understanding. She had confessed to passing up the chance to have her father write a letter that might have reduced his sentence.
"But if you hadn't your ideals," he'd written, "you'd be no different from the others," sipping champagne at Black's.
For his part, Alistair found it hard to believe that she did not despise him for jumping the evacuation queue. But perhaps this was love, at the second time of asking.
the understanding that each would not mind what had been necessary locally. In the light of the chandelier, men in lounge suits converged on their table in oblique trajectories described by the pull of desire and the push of manners. They noticed Hilda's face when they were already too close and swerved. Some had prepared opening gambits that they swallowed. Others made attempts of varying skill to demonstrate that they had only been on their way to the lavatory. Hilda looked into a third gin. "This will be my whole life, you know."
"You mustn't think that. It's hard to stay gay, though. Do they imagine I'm cut all the way through?"
Mary was drunk enough to touch Hilda's scars.
"What's this on them? Healing cream?" "It's foundation, damn you."
Mary drew her hand back.
"I'm sorry."
"Not that it does any good. I could wear a carnival mask and the scars would still show through."
"And so? Damn these spivs and idlers. A million better men will come home from the war, and they shan't want a girl who's sat it out. When Simonson looks at your scars, he'll see someone."
"I'm afraid he won't want to look. He shan't want to be reminded." Mary leaned back, exhaled, and watched her smoke rise.
"What sort of man do you want, anyway?"
"Tall. Funny. Never came top of his class, or pulled the wings off bees."
"Yes, but I mean, really. When all of this is over, and assuming we win..."
"Oh, I think we'll win, don't you? Now that the Americans are all in."
"Yes, but there'll be such a mess to sort out. Not just all the rebuilding. We'll have to put society back together, in some better configuration."
Hilda snorted.
"What?"
said Mary. "Well, we want such different things from men. You earnestly want someone who will help you reform society." Mary smiled.
"Whereas you
just want a tall man and a stiff drink. You could even swap the adjectives." Mary looked out over the tables, each white linen world orbiting the great central chandelier of the lounge, each world encircled in turn by its moons of women and men, laughing and drinking, occulting and eclipsing. How rudderless one was, in truth. How governed by unmastered forces. Hilda touched her hand.
"I haven't upset you, have I?" "Not at all," said Mary.
But now her own heart faltered. For these long months she had held on to the idea of love so fiercely that she had not considered a daunting possibility, that she didn't love Alistair after all, that his great merit was in having known her only before she fell apart, while her great cowardice was not to have admitted to him that she was diminished. She wasn't the girl who had once walked in bombs as if they were drizzle. She had lost her exemption from the ordinary, and as soon as he realized it, he wouldn't love her either. She twisted her hands in her lap. How well did they know each other, after all? She and Alistair had never had the civilian progression into love by small and reversible steps, by increments of dancing and dinner in which joy was imperceptibly solemnized. All they had had was an air raid, and a moment at Waterloo Station, and £2 by weight of aerograms that might one day be discovered, in a suitcase, in some attic being converted to a flat and flung into a waste cart with old books and cups.
"But you look so glum," said Hilda. "Don't be silly. You're getting cold feet, aren't you? It's just... I mean, what if... Oh, Hilda, I can barely remember his face."
"You're panicking, you silly fruit."
"Do you think?"
"He's a little late, that's all it is, and you have altar nerves." "I'll bet Alistair's just the same. He'll be in a pub round the corner, getting up some Dutch courage. Breathe, that's it. Take a really good deep breath." Mary felt a little better. Drinks came, magnifying the effect. "Now listen," said Hilda, licking gin from the end of her cocktail straw and jabbing it in Mary's direction. "What you need is to take out his photo." Mary laughed. "I shan't sit here mooning over him."
"You know the trouble?"
said Hilda, rummaging in Mary's bag for her. "Your mother bred all the sense out of you. Now look," she said, slapping the brownish vignette of Alistair down among the ash and the coasters. "Look at that and tell me you're not in love." How many times Mary had stared at Alistair's photograph. Once it had provoked a simple gladness.
"Oh, I don't know," said Mary. "What would you have me say? That he is beautiful? That you love him? Only that. But it's been so long, and I'm such a mess. I hardly remember..."
"Then think. What was the spark?" "The hour you looked into those eyes and thought,
I want no one else. God knows I can remember.
Mary stared at Alistair's portrait. It didn't seem kind to tell Hilda that it hadn't been his eyes at all, but his back. She'd known with certainty that she needed him only when he had turned away from her on the platform at Waterloo. How her heart had dropped, as if there were no end to falling. When the hour had come for the war to take him away, that had been the first and last moment she had known without doubt that she loved him. One knew how one felt only when things ended. And yet here was the world of white tables, insisting on beginnings. And here was Alistair now, with a footman throwing open the door of the lounge. Here was Alistair, tall and gaunt, the chandelier showering him with light. Here he was, in his uniform, smiling and unsteady, his right sleeve empty and pinned. Here was Alistair, meeting her eye. Mary stood, knocking over her drink. Gin sluiced over the tablecloth and deepened the red plush of the carpet. "Alistair," she said, so overcome that she forgot to embrace him and instead offered her hand to shake. It was ridiculous, and even worse since she offered her right, which he had to take with his left. "Hello, Mary." They disengaged. He raised and then dropped his good arm, helplessly. "Sorry I'm late. There were Germans." Mary managed a laugh. Alistair too. "Hello, Alistair," said Hilda. "Gin all right with you?"
"Gin? Fine."
"Hello, Hilda. How are you?"
"Back in a jiffy," said Hilda, giving them the table.
"Her poor face," said Alistair, as Hilda curved to the lavatory. "Shrapnel," said Mary.
Gin came, and Alistair took a sip. He grimaced and widened his eyes.
"Nice," said Mary.
"I'd almost forgotten what we were fighting for. And you only look more beautiful."
"You're very kind. But it's the war, I'm afraid. I'm so much older."
Alistair gave her a look so tender that she thought she might dissolve. The two of them might be all right, she realized. She must make more effort to take it slowly this time, that was all. Life took longer to reassemble than it did to blow apart, but that didn't mean it wouldn't be lovely, providing that one remembered to go for country walks and to tune the wireless to music.
"You haven't missed the weather," she said. "It's mostly rained since you left."
Alistair took in the Ritz's lounge, the laughter, the crystals of light that flattered the crowd. He said,
"I thought I wouldn't make it back to all this. I was sinking by the time the Navy pulled us out. I was going down, and there was this great roaring noise, which was the sound of the rescue launch's engines, but I thought it was the end. They had to pump my chest."
The words struggled to connect, and Mary found herself already saying,
"And of course it snowed a lot in January."
Hilda appeared back at the table, all purpose and powder.
"Well," she said, "I shall leave you lovebirds to it."
Mary took her arm.
"You mustn't go."
Mistaking her terror, Hilda kissed her on both cheeks.
"Don't be silly. I'll be fine. I shall call at the garret tomorrow to catch up on all the news."
She gave Mary a look of tipsy significance.
"But I shan't arrive before noon."
"Oh, Hilda, you really don't need to..."
"Nonsense. Now, be good, you two, and if you can't be good, be a warning to others."
She was gone with a wave of the fingers, weaving between the tables. A waiter dimmed the chandelier. The pianist took a break.
"In Malta it was mostly sunny," said Alistair, "but there could be a terrible wind."
"I was so desperate when I heard you were missing," said Mary at the same time.
Their hands, a foot apart on the tablecloth, could not seem to make the junction. The pianist sat back down and played La Campanella. More drinks came. Alistair packed his pipe, not making too bad a fist of it with one hand, Mary thought. A waiter arrived to light it from a cut glass lamp. The staff at the Ritz had the quality of apologising with a murmur for each of their perfect actions. They smelled of nothing and had faces that made no demands on the eye or on the heart. They melted into shade, not allowing themselves to be silhouetted against the chandelier. They eluded cognition entirely, like sorcerers or fathers. At the tables all around them, the guests chattered away as if life were not on the meter, while the waiters took away ash.
"I think I should warn you," said Mary.
I ought to let you know, said Alistair.
You go,
said Mary.
Please, you first.
Someone dimmed the chandelier further, until it seemed to cast a light that was darker than its absence. The high notes scattered from the piano. They glittered in that thin register where one heard the strings and hammers.
What were you going to say? Said Alistair.
Oh, it was nothing. You?
Only that... Oh, it can wait.
Drinks came. The pianist played some nocturnes of Chopin. Black-coated waiters appeared out of the black background to light Mary's cigarettes. One had only to think of fire, and fire came, as if the incendiary thoughts scorched the air. One had only to need a drink, and the pull of the need itself caused the drink to arrive on a heavy tray in a glass that had been handled with white cotton. It might carry on all night, Mary supposed, this matching of an equal and opposite solution to every resolvable human need, done with this exquisite precision that extended to the fullest extremity of the possible, and therefore only made one ache all the more despairingly with doubts that one could never be soothed by lackeys. It was the perfect antithesis of the war, this torment of solicitude. How strange that the struggle and its absence should leave one equally afraid.
Mary, are you quite all right?
Alistair had his hand on her arm.
Thank you, darling. I'm fine.
And she would be fine, of course. She would make conversation when the air seemed the right shape for it, and she would laugh when laughter seemed a better fit. It was nice that the drinks kept coming, since the glow they gave was terrific. He took his hand away.
What would you like us to do now?
Well, they do a nice dinner here, although it's getting rather late. Or we could go to one of the cafes on Haymarket, or if you're not hungry, we might even still make the cinema.
Yes, he said, but I suppose what I meant was, what would you like now for us?
Mary gripped the table. The room revolved around the chandelier. Their white planets spun through the plush, black, smoky space.
I'm sorry, said Alistair. I'm ahead of myself. Ignore me. This is what I was like after France. That's what I was trying to warn you about earlier on.
It's all right. I so look forward to seeing you again. I thought I would know just what to do when you came.
I'm sorry.
He nodded and looked away to the other tables where guests glowed in firmer orbits.
On Malta, with the blockade, one doesn't imagine that people live like this at home. It is hard to imagine how hungry everyone is on the island.
I can imagine it, she said,
feeling even as she said it what a foolish thing it was to blurt out. He smiled kindly enough, but now she saw herself as he must. In the bright light of the chandelier, before he arrived, London's circle had seemed quite equal to the Earth's equator. Now she saw the smallness of it. How vain she had been in her nest, feathering it with mirrors. She was a teacher nobody needed, a daughter whose parents despaired. And now here was Alistair, this man who had stood up to the enemy while she had been so proud of standing up to her mother.
Did she really sit at this table? Even now, in her new feathered hat, wondering if she loved him? "I'm sorry," she said.
His face was pale with concern.
"Whatever for?" "Forgive me," she said, standing abruptly so that the chair fell to the carpet. "Please, darling, forgive me."
She fled into the blacked-out night, into the ruined city beyond the constellation of chandeliers. For a moment Alistair thought to go after her, but he was afraid that he could not have understood the situation. There must be something monstrous about him that had made her run. He was even more ruined than he had thought. He sat in his uniform at the empty table, while a waiter righted the overturned chair without irritation or comment. The pianist played without interruption. Mary's place was cleared, the glass and its coaster removed on an electroplate tray. The tablecloth swept of ash until there was no sign she had ever been there. How abruptly people were taken. His body grieved, while his thoughts struggled to recall how he had got there. He had carried her body all the way back to barracks, and collapsed unconscious in the guardhouse. No, that wasn't it. He had not opened the jar she had given him, carrying it instead to War's End. No, that wasn't it at all. he had loved her. It had been the tiniest chance that he would still be sitting there, and when Mary saw him she cut corners between the other tables, not minding the diner's indignation. When she appeared by Alistair, out of breath, it seemed to startle him. He looked up from a drink that couldn't still have been his first.
"Mary?"
"This place," she said. "It isn't me. Think what you like of me, but I wanted to tell you that."
He stood, needing the table for balance.
"What place is more you?"
"I don't have a place any more."
"Is there somewhere you might feel better, at least?"
"I like the river," she said. "I went there sometimes, when you were missing."
"Should we go there now?"
"I don't know. It's late."
He checked his watch. "What time do they switch the Thames off?"
"Are you furious at me?"
"No. I thought you were disappointed."
A waiter had been hovering, uncertain whether to bring cognac or coats.
"What would you like to do?"
Mary asked Alistair.
"I'll walk, if you'd like to. We don't have to go anywhere in particular."
"I'm slow on my leg, I should warn you."
"I'll do the sprinting, then, if you'll do the handstands."
Outside, an unused moon was rising. It shone along the axes of Piccadilly and sent their shadows west. As they walked down to the embankment, Mary's mood, which had lifted for a moment, began to sink again. Alistair could take her arm only with his left, and since her left side was the one needing support, they tended to separate. The awkwardness leached into the silence between them. The Thames, when they reached it, was no help. With its silvered crests in the soft night air, it should have seemed dear, but she saw the slick blackness of the troughs, and felt on her skin the sobering drop in temperature. They walked south along the river. Parliament seemed indigo in the light. The plane trees of Millbank had limbs splintered here and there by the bombing. They spoke of these small things, grateful when they presented themselves. When they reached the Tate, they saw that the bombing had blown its roofs off. Alistair was shaken and wanted to look. Inside, the mosaic floors were wrecked and the rain had washed their tiles out. 10,000 coloured marble chips, blued by the moonlight, lay in a mound at the foot of the stairs. Alistair went ahead into the galleries and Mary hung back, poking at the mess with her toe. It seemed redundant to follow him, now that he had seen her as she was. She had only ever been an imprint in the London clay of inherited money and looks. How pleased she had been with the impression she made, thinking it her own. But there were thousands of her stamp, and thousands more would come, each imagining they escaped the pattern. There would be countless small rebellions, numberless mothers defied. After the war, these tiles would all be picked up and stuck back where they'd fallen. She stood beneath the shattered central dome of the gallery. Above, between the bare iron hoops, a halo had formed round the moon. She lit a cigarette. The sound of the lighter rang in the empty space and sent pigeons clacking up through the dome. What good was she to him? And yet days still came and had to be faced. Perhaps she should go back home. As soon as an occasion presented, her mother would invite the Hunter Halls. Mary would seat herself as instructed, which she supposed would decide everything else. Society was not complicated, after all. One had only to follow one's first name from table plan to wedding bands and all the way through to the headstone. She stubbed out her cigarette and edged through the gloom in the direction Alistair had gone. In the galleries, a damp line had risen from the floor, a pale fungus in numberless dots marking the creeping edge of it. On the ashen walls, a thousand lighter rectangles showed where each painting had hung and to where it would be restored. How foolish she was! Still to hope that Alistair could love her. And yet she followed him, into the dark, even though she knew that each step took her no further from who she was. When the war was over, the evacuees would return. The zoo animals would be put back on trucks and returned to their old labelled cages. The world could not wake from its pattern. The tarnished brass title plaques were still screwed into the gallery walls. In the moonlight they glowed dully. Precisely here and here had been the constables and the turners. Here had been Ophelia, and here she would be again, chanting snatches of old tunes. Footsteps came, and she turned. "Why did you run out?" said Alistair. "I couldn't bear myself. You, with everything you've been through, and then me and my small miseries and the Ritz." She put her face in her hands.
"The Ritz?"
He looked around. "This place doesn't feel like me either. I don't think I'm anxious to fix it."
"Do you think, if you can stand it, we might try to find a place for us?"
His face hardened a little, and he said nothing.
"Alistair?"
she said, her heart racing.
"I don't know. Do you think you'd even be happy?"
"My mother thinks that isn't even a word in wartime."
"I don't mind what your mother thinks."
"I would try to be happy. I can be fun, you know. I hope we can be that way again."
"I might let you down," he said. "I don't sleep. My mind isn't right."
"But we do let each other down, don't we? And it isn't the end."
"I don't know. You might have been right when you ran out."
She dropped her hands to her sides.
"But you might have come after me. I only needed one kind word, you know. I don't know how to begin now that we finally might."
"I'm sorry. I wish I hadn't let you go."
"And I wish I hadn't run. But this is us from the start, don't you think? We get so close each time. Darling, we get so close."
"Were we wrong from the start?" said Alistair. "To pretend we weren't in love?"
"I was wrong. I was a coward not to tell Tom. Do you despise me for it?"
He shook his head.
"I should have said I loved you. Would that have been the difference?"
"It's the difference now. Do you think you might tell me if you still do, or if you don't? It's all right either way, you know. I'm sure now that it's braver to say it."
He got his pipe lit and leaned back against the wall of the gallery. She leaned beside him, an arm's width away, and they looked at the pattern of the absent paintings.
"I don't know how to answer you," he said. "I don't have feelings as I used to. These pictures used to move me."
"I used to move you."
He took her hand. "I went so far down before they pulled me out."
"I'm sorry."
She looked at her hand in his.
"You still care, at least."
"I care that your leg must be aching. I care that I must be making you sad. I care for a thousand things I would like to make better for you."
"Then might you still try, Alistair? Could you love me again, with time?"
"I'm so afraid in case I won't."
"And I'm so afraid in case I always will."
She kissed him, and they stood for a time without speaking. Mary felt the weight of their silence, but there was no sadness in it, because the silence had not yet found its moment to slip from the heart and lodge itself in the ordinary. Perhaps, if the two of them were careful, then it never would. Perhaps the real work of lovers was to hold themselves apart from theatres and train stations, from jam jars and picture frames, from all the bellicose everyday things that sought to beat one with time. Even to hope for love was a trap, Mary supposed, if when one said love, one only meant armistice. Maybe it was foolish to imagine any more definite thing, since the heart, after all, did not declare victory. The heart declared only forgiveness, for which there was no grand precedent and no instrument of surrender. Her leg was giving out, and she sank to the floor. Alistair joined her. In the empty gallery they sat, a little distance apart, not so far that life could easily get between them, but not so close that it couldn't if it tried. They stared into the pattern of lighter grey shapes where paintings ought to be. Through the holes in the roof and the cracks in the walls, the city grew lighter around them. Their ancient city, with its ordered tides reverting to the sea. And now, from the river in the east, rose a vivid red sun, surprising Mary. She hadn't meant to sleep. The day had got in through the broken dome and flooded the gallery wall. It blinded her, and she blinked until the world was restored. Beside her in the ruins, Alistair lay with his eyes closed, without a mark on him. The quick, bright shock of the light between the cloud and the eastern horizon. An unimaginable thing, thought Mary. A life. It was an unscrewing of tarnished brass plaques. It was one tile lost to the pattern. It was an air one might still breathe if everyone forgiven was brave.
This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.